As we come to the end of this sitting, I'd like to offer you contemplative reflection to include as part of the sitting. And if there are some small adjustments in your posture you'd like to make to be a little more comfortable, it's fine to do. And this is a very simple practice. I'm going to go through a list of 10 qualities, 10 virtues or ideals that are highly revered in all Buddhist traditions. And as you hear the concept, take it in as if it's a quality you have. Potential you have, a quality of your own. So it's not something you have to live up to so much as to recognize, even if it's a very small amount, that's something that's within you. A reminder. Or perhaps it evokes something about this quality in you. And after I've said the word, we'll have silence for a little bit, and if a little bit, you just want to repeat the word to yourself and seeing what bubbles up, seeing what parts of yourself are touched. Generosity. Virtue, integrity, letting go. Wisdom. Effort. Patience. Determination. Truthfulness. Loving kindness. Equanimity. So, what I'm planning to do today could be called an exercise in theology. in Buddhist theology. It's kind of theology in the sense that it's a Buddhist theory, or it's an attempt to try to construct a kind of Buddhist theory. Probably most of you would never want to come to a talk on Buddhist theology. But I thought to be honest about what I'm doing to you, tell you this is what I'm doing, as opposed to you guys assuming that here, this is the way I was taught by my teachers, and this has been this way since the time of the Buddha. So it's really, you know, I've tried to take in a lot of the teachings I've heard and a lot of different elements of the practice I was introduced to, and the texts and Buddhism and history and ideas. And so it's kind of an attempt to synthesize them or hold them together, and hopefully what is an interesting way, and useful way for all of us. So I want to start by telling a story that I've heard about the Dalai Lama. I've heard it now a few times. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But the story was, I think it was in Los Angeles, and it was one of these really big conventions, conferences. Oh, I'm getting to that list, by the way, that you recited. This is, you know, so in case you're wondering, what happened to that? So it was this big, big gatherings with, you know, thousands of people listening to the Dalai Lama. And I guess at the end of it, at the end of the one day or the end of the week or something, there was a chance to ask him questions. And I don't know if people stood up and asked the questions. They wrote out the questions by paper and he'd read them. And someone asked him the question, what is the quickest way to enlightenment? And he didn't answer right away. And as was told, he was just quiet for a long time. And as was told, he started crying. And then he said something like, here in America, people are in such a hurry. They want enlightenment, they want the goods, they want everything right away, they want it tomorrow, they want it today. You should evaluate your practice. You shouldn't even begin evaluating your spiritual practice until you've been practicing for 10 years or 20 years. Part of the context for the Dalai Lama is that in his understanding of his what he's been doing through his many lifetimes, because he believes in many lifetimes, that he's been engaged in spiritual practice probably for more lifetimes than there are ants on this planet. And you ask him, what's the quickest way? You know, he's in it for the long haul, for a long time. And I was really touched by this, at least the story I heard it, that he cried when he heard this person who wanted the quickest way. It's a reasonable question. You have lots of teachers who say this is the quickest way, and, you know, why waste time? But what's lost in that is that perhaps there is one aspect of a spiritual life which involves long periods of time, the long haul. And part of it is the development of our character, or the development of our inner potentials and qualities. I had no idea when I started Buddhist practice that character was important, or that there were all these inner qualities, inner potentials that could be developed, and that developing them provided a very important foundation for deepening one's spiritual life. And, you know, I was kind of, in a sense, a character of my early approach was, you know, enlightenment or bust. You know, just straight to the deep stuff and the most profound things now. And what happened was kind of behind the scenes when I wasn't looking, I was doing my practice, kind of unbeknownst to me, was the practice was developing various qualities in me. And I didn't come to develop these qualities, but in retrospect, I realized a number of things were being developed. The first thing I realized in retrospect was compassion. I had no interest in compassion when I started my Zen practice. I didn't, you know, it wasn't really in my vocabulary. I knew what it was, kind of, but I didn't use it, you know. But I was being compassionate. by the whole practice experience of, that I was involved in, meditation and everything. And it really opened my heart in a dramatic way. I also developed a sense of discipline. A sense of discipline and determination, resolve. And I didn't realize that I was doing that. It just, that was kind of, you know, you had to wake up every morning at early and show up in the meditation hall and other all kinds of things you had to kind of hang in there for. Or I would sit there with pain. I'd have physical pain when I sat. And then just not to move or run away or whatever when I had the pain, took some kind of inner strength. I was really, that part of me was really weak when I started. But, you know, very, very slowly, that kind of muscle got stronger and stronger. The resolve, dedication, the patience, the insight, the self-understanding that it took to really stay there with pain and not cave into it. I remember once, I think maybe it was my first or second sesshin, and it was the last sitting of the evening. And the way it was set up was that the sitting didn't end until the abbot came back into the meditation hall and did a little ritual. And he was busy giving interviews, and that maybe it was a long interview. So it was, you know, rather than being the usual 40-minute sitting, it was a really long sitting, like it was going on and on. I was, you know, waiting. And Zen, you're not supposed to move at all. It's like, you know, to say it's the law is too mild. It's like, you know, you don't move. So, you know, I was sitting there and not moving, and it was so painful. And, you know, please come, please come. And he wouldn't come. Just sitting there was pain. And I don't know how long it lasted, but at some point, I caved in. I just said, I gave up. And then he walked through the door. And there I was, you know, a mess there. But anyway, slowly, that kind of, these strengths developed. And I wasn't thinking about that was going on, but that was kind of the side effect of what was going on. If you go to Burma or Thailand, especially in Burma, I heard this, not quite as much in Thailand, but there is an idea that a person can only go as far in their spiritual practice as their developed character allows them to. As their character development allows them to, as these inner strengths. You have to have sufficient inner strength to go a certain depth in practice, certain maturity in practice. And if some person came to kind of plateau in their meditation practice and kind of wouldn't go any farther, the teachers would say, oh, that person hasn't developed these inner strengths, these inner qualities. And the person should go out and develop those qualities. And sometimes they'd say, well, those qualities will get developed as they continue their meditation practice. It's kind of a side effect. But sometimes they would tell you, you should go out into the world and develop those qualities by the kind of activities that actually develops them. And then come back. So these qualities are a list of 10. And the word that's used to describe them is the paramis in Pali. Some of you might be more familiar with the Sanskrit word, which is the paramitas. And there's different lists of them. There's 6 paramis and there's 10 paramis, or paramitas, 6 paramitas. The word paramita, usually, and paramis, is usually translated as perfections. It's because you develop these qualities to the perfect state, or these the qualities that perfect the human being, perfect the person, different ways in which it's described. And the Pali, paramis, comes much closer. It comes from the root to perfect. The Sanskrit paramita has a little different etymology. It has the meaning, para means other. And here it means the other shore. And itta is understood to mean to go. So to go to the other shore, to cross to the other shore. Those qualities that take you across the shore, across the flood of samsara, the flood of greed, hate, and delusion, to this floor, the shore of liberation. So these are the qualities that help you take you across, either that'll take you across the shore, the boat, the raft, that'll give you the strength to pass across. And usually these paramis or paramitas are associated with the bodhisattva path in Buddhism. The bodhisattva path is that path which leads a person to becoming a Buddha. And it's considered to be very, very, you need a lot of spiritual maturation. You need a lot of these character building, these inner strengths, in order to be primed, in order to become a Buddha. So it's usually associated with the bodhisattva path. But in the Theravadan tradition, at some point it became understood that even for people who are not on a bodhisattva path, who are not trying to become Buddhas for themselves, but were basically just trying to become, you know, ordinary and enlightened people. they also needed to have a certain measure of these paramitas developed. They didn't have to develop to the same degree as someone trying to become a Buddha, but they had to be present. And that's why they would say, if there weren't enough of these present for you, yourself, you should go out and develop those. Or they can happen together in tandem. Your meditation practice, you can go together with doing other practices that develop these qualities. Now, what gets more interesting, and this is where what I've said now is not my theology, but now the next one kind of is now letting you know, where I'm kind of going off the deep end, or is, well, not exactly, but so the, I'm sorry that it's, all these caveats probably doesn't help the talk. So there's 10 paramis in the Pali tradition, in our tradition. And they're the ones I listed in the end of the talk. They are generosity, virtue. I said letting go in the meditation, but actually the word is renunciation. But I didn't want to frighten you. you know, in the meditation, you know, it's kind of like you have to, you know, it's like, you warn people before they see a movie that has a lot of violence in it, you know. So renunciation is kind of a difficult word for Westerners. So I said letting go, that's easier. So generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, effort, patience, determination, truthfulness, loving kindness, and equanimity. So there are different strengths. And I find it very useful when you have these kind of lists in Buddhism, especially ideals like this, is not to take them on as a burden, like a should, so much. Oh, not to live up to this, or now, you know, this, you know, makes my life so complicated. It's a long list of things, and there's the Four Noble Truths, and the Five Faculties, and Seven Factors of Awakening, and boy. But rather to take them as something that you already have, something you're already doing. And it might be just a little teeny itsy-bitsy corner of your heart where that's going on. But take it from that point of view. You're already doing it rather than something you have to impose from the outside. And once you can find where you're already part of who you are, then try to promote it and to develop that. And encourage it. Because one of the things that's said in Buddhism is that paying attention, bringing attention, the food of attention, of awareness, to your wholesome qualities feeds them, develops them. So if you know to look, be on the lookout for equanimity or patience and to value it, then actually you strengthen that patience much more than if you didn't value it. So it's said in the Theravadan tradition that these qualities, generosity, virtue, and so forth, which are common to many people, are only become paramis, paramitas, when they're joined together with compassion and skillful means. So if you could be very generous for all kinds of motivations, but it doesn't become a parami unless part of the motivation for the act of generosity is compassion, is somehow a concern, compassionate concern for yourself and for others. And it doesn't become a parami. Generosity doesn't move over and become a parami unless it's also connected to what's called skillful means, which is in the Theravada tradition means it's used, it's being done and used or enacted on or lived by or being expressed in order for the purposes of becoming liberated. So a person can be generous for all kinds of reasons again, but it isn't necessarily as a way of helping them become liberated. It's not necessarily an expression of compassion and compassionate concern for people around you. So the foundation, in order to create a foundation that supports spiritual practice, we develop these qualities, or we're born with them. Some teachers would say, you know, you did a lot of this work in a past life, and so some people are born with them, and you're just, you know, lucky that way or whatever. And but whatever reasons, you know, some people have, you know, or have these more than others, but. But in order to develop them, if we're going to develop them, we have to understand how they're connected to compassion and skillful means. That means, and this is the theology part, that means that in order for us to develop our practice, whether we're on the bodhisattva path or we're on the ordinary kind of people kind of enlightenment path, like us, most of us, I suppose, that there has to be some connection to compassion. There has to be some connection to liberation. That the liberation and compassion help create the foundation, a strong foundation for letting us plunge into the depths of a spiritual life, which sometimes can be quite frightening, quite disorienting, because it can be so radically different from how we usually understand both ourselves and the world around us. And it requires a lot of fortitude in order to really follow through in a persistent way, to hang in there like Dalai Lama thinks, you know, for 10, 20 years or lifetimes or whatever. In order to have the strength to stay in there, have the patience, have the equanimity, have the honesty to kind of stay in there and work with it day after day. And I am so in awe. Once I became a teacher, and I'd been a teacher long enough to have kind of have students kind of who I knew their practice over, you know, over many years, I have become so in awe of how these practitioners change and grow and develop, and the power of the practice, and, you know, the inner strength and the strength of intention, the strength of wisdom and understanding and compassion that, you know, that develop. And sometimes, you know, it's really remarkable given where people start. You know, I'm amazed, you know, how wonderful it is. The classic treatise on the paramis explains that generosity is offered as the first one because it's the easiest to do. And, you know, it's just a matter of physically giving something to someone, maybe, for example, or smiling, giving someone a smile. And I can do very little for my new baby, who's now 5 months old. You know, you can do the standard things, but to really kind of see, you know, make him really happy. You know, if I change a diaper, it doesn't necessarily make him, you know, I don't notice that he's particularly happy, he just stops crying. But if I can smile really nicely and make him fool of myself, then he smiles. You know, I give him my smile and he smiles. It's one of the few things I can actually do for him, you know, to make him happy. And I believe that one of my beliefs, one of my theologies, is that it's impossible to continue in Buddhist practice after a certain point unless a person feels the practice is connected to other people. You're doing it for the sake of other people also. And a person can go along for years quite well in practice without any concern, you know, that their practice is really going to help other people. There's no need, there's no moral imperative you have to do this. But at some point, you come to a point, where if you're going to continue any further, you'd only do it if you felt that your practice was connected to the welfare of others. Otherwise, you simply wouldn't continue. And there are people who take the practice quite far and at some point feel satisfied and then will, you know, stop the practice and be in enlightened retirement. So I'm really happy with the idea, at least that the Theravada tradition, at least parts of it, understand that how intimately practice is connected to compassion. So what do you think of that? Does that sound like a burden? Does it inspire you or make you happy? Or what do you think of this concept so far? I'd like to hear from you before I continue. Yes, Pesha.
Could you explain what skillful means?
Oh, skillful means skillful means different things in different Buddhist traditions. In the Theravada tradition, skillful means are those inner qualities, and sometimes understood inner practices, but qualities that you have that lead a person to liberation. Those are the skillful means that you have. Those are skillful qualities, skillful dhamma, skillful. So in being generous, if you feel your generosity is connected to your aspiration for liberation, to be free of all clinging, then the skillful means conjoined with the generosity. But the person can be generous. Lots of people are generous. It's really inspiring to see how many people are generous, you know, how wonderful. Many people are generous. It never occurred to them that they're being generous, or part of their generosity is part of a practice. It's part of in the context of their own liberation. They're just doing it because it's, you know, a good thing to do, and their parents told them to, and it's a good thing, or whatever. So it means you have to have some understanding of what liberation means. And then you have to have some sense that this practice of generosity is supporting that, or connected to it, or enhancing that direction, that possibility. It's not so difficult to do that with generosity, because one of the classic definitions of liberation is that it's freedom from all clinging. Absolutely every poor thing you can cling to. And in order to give something away to someone, there has to be some relinquishment of your attachments to it. So you're kind of exercising that. You could be exercising that in the act of generosity. Yeah, so it's part of an intentional life where you actually, you've reflected on it, your intention, you've developed it. And after a while, it becomes kind of second nature. But you know, somewhere, there's a momentum, you set the momentum in motion where this is the orientation that your practice is about.
Could you speak more about renunciation?
Well, again, renunciation can seem very, very closely connected to freedom from clinging, because renunciation means you let go of something. But renunciation has more than just letting go of something. Because giving means you give something, renunciation means you're not necessarily giving something to someone, you're just letting go of, you're clinging to it. Part of renunciation is to realize that there are a lot of worthwhile things to do in life. And one human being can't do them all. And so if you really want to do one thing well, you're going to have to renounce some things, you know, at least temporarily, in order to really follow through. If you spread yourself too thin, you can't really get the momentum going, the charge going to really, you know. If you want to learn to play the guitar, and you pick up the guitar, you know, once a month, and strum it for, you know, 20 minutes, and then but you have a lot of other hobbies, you know, like that, and every once a month you pick them up, you're not really going to develop the momentum in your fingers and the coordination and the sense of music and all that it takes to really learn the guitar. You have to have some ongoing momentum building. And so you need to practice maybe every day. So same thing with a spiritual life. So you need to have that, you need to, if you really want to take the practice as far as it can go with you, you have to have some real dedication. You're going to do it enough so you can feel that, you know, that it's working within you. You're working it, it's working you, and you're kind of keeping the fire a little bit going. In order to do that, I think for most people, it takes, not everyone, but it takes some degree of renunciation, especially in this modern life that many people live, where there's, you know, so many options and so many things we feel like we need to do to be fulfilled. I think if some kind of renunciation is necessary. And we do that temporarily by going on retreat, you know, 10 days. You're not asked to do this, but you come there and you go, wow, I didn't know I was asked to do that. But for example, you're asked to be celibate. So celibacy is one of the classic forms of renunciation. You go to, you know, Spirit Rock, state-of-the-art meditation center. It's built like the Hilton. And you show up and you're told to be celibate for 10 days. And So you give up. Also, you renounce Spirit Rock and retreats. For example, you renounce temporarily social speech. Most forms of speech is kind of renounced for the benefits of going, you know, that silence can give you. So renunciation usually has a trade-off, where you realize, understand how renouncing this particular thing is helpful for a goal that you have in mind. You don't renounce because you're an ascetic and just, you know, you're going to beat yourself up and some idea that you're a purer person because you renounce. I don't think that that's a Buddhist idea, that you attain moral purity by just, you know, renouncing things. But you renounce because it's helpful and conducive for the path of liberation. Yeah.
Question.
That's a big topic, you know, what is enlightenment and liberation, but I think your motivation is beautiful, so I'm quite content with that, and rather than looking for me to, you know, to say what the tradition would judge your, you know, the connection, I just encourage you to, if to look and see, do you feel a connection? Is your attainment of non-duality supported by the cultivation of these inner strengths? There's a wonderful story, I don't know if it's wonderful, but in Irving Yalom's book, Love's Executioner, and I think it's the first story in there. It's a story of him working with clients. He's a psychotherapist here in the peninsula. And so it's kind of true accounts, cases of his working with his clients. And he works, I guess he's working with a woman, but the story is that there's a another therapist who's gone off and done a Vipassana retreat in India, 10-day retreat, and has come back from this very powerful retreat with not feeling the usual dualism between self and other. And so this therapist then feels tremendous empathy and care for this very lonely, exactly a story, but something like this, this very lonely, elderly widow. And so his professional boundaries between how you help such a person became rather fuzzy. And they had a romantic relationship, I think, story. Is that what happened? Somebody read it? And so she comes to Irving Yalom for help because, you know, that's a very traumatic thing to have happened, to have your therapist be in a romantic relationship with you. And so, you know, Irving kind of helps him out. But it's an example of a certain kind of, you know, he probably attained something of significance, but he didn't have the support and the understanding, the wisdom to hold that non-dualistic or, falling away of the sharp divide between self and other. That can happen. It's very beautiful to have that happen. But if it happens without some sense of integrity and virtue and honesty and loving kindness and a lot of other qualities, it can be very dangerous. So may you not attain complete non-duality until you're ready. For our sake. Yes?
So the way I was hearing you describe the paramis and compassion and skillfulness, those are sort of avenues for executing the paramis, perhaps?
Right. So a person can then look for opportunities to develop those. And so some people might...
Through the compassion and through the skillful means.
So this is interesting because in practices like generosity and virtue, in and of themselves, are important foundations for the Buddhist spiritual life. But it certainly helps just to do them. But if you understand in doing them that they're connected to your compassionate concern, then you're also developing the paramis, which is a kind of different kind of strength, or maybe a different degree, or I don't know exactly how it works. So rather than simply you developing ordinary generosity and the benefits that come from that, you're getting a whole other category of benefit in addition when you understand that what you're doing is connected to compassionate concern.
I had almost expected, I hadn't heard the paramis before, I had expected your compassion listed as one of them, but not as sort of an overriding, I'm not quite sure how to frame it. I mean, and I could imagine that wisdom could be placed as you stated, sort of compassion, that you could execute the paramis through wisdom. I'm a little confused, I think, about the differences of this list of paramis and compassion and skillful means.
Well, I guess compassion and skillful means is a part of each one. So it's kind of presupposed. It's kind of the foundation for the paramis, for doing the paramis. So that has to be there first.
Could an effort or wisdom or generosity be components of all the rest of them also?
Yeah, and some people will say that develop any one of them completely, the others follow. So they're all kind of like a hologram, or kind of all kind of interconnected that way. And even some people will say, you know, that if you simply sit wholeheartedly in that wholehearted sitting, you fulfill all of them. So you don't have to actually do anything, you know, to fulfill them. And some classic texts say all you need to do is cultivate the perfection of insight, and the other paramitas follow with that, perfection of wisdom, follow from that. And so they're just kind of singular approach. And that's certainly valid, but I think that it's also important to, I think it's useful to kind of understand the principle of what's going on here, to appreciate it. So it's just interesting to be aware of it and notice these things in oneself. And then to think about, you know, would it be useful, would it be wise to spend some time developing some of these? I feel like for myself that one of my strengths in practice has been my resolve, my capacity for resolve. Like, for example, I don't think of myself as someone who has natural capacity for concentration. And I've developed a lot of concentration over the years, and I can get concentrated now fairly well, but it wasn't like, you know, something that came naturally to me. Like I know practitioners, it's like a natural, it just comes to them naturally. But what I have is a strength of resolve. And so that resolve carries me into the concentrated state. So, you know, that's what my strength has been. But I can imagine someone noticing that maybe they don't have a lot of resolve. You know, and I look at some practitioners and I wish they had more resolve. And so they could say, well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the lack of resolve, and let's talk about ways that you can develop that. And are there healthy ways of developing that and having that level of determination and, you know, sticking with something and really seeing it through? I know some people, I had one friend of mine who had a very, very hard time in her personal life. And she was a very dedicated practitioner. And her Buddhist teacher gave her the practice of generosity. And she thrived with it. She didn't really sit very much for a long time. She just practiced generosity. She looked for opportunities to be generous. And over time, that provided a sense of inner well-being, inner strength, a lot of things, inner understanding. A lot of things came with through the practice of generosity. And it created a foundation, which later she was able to go further in practice. So, you know, so some people, maybe it's virtue. And I meet plenty of people for whom, not that often, but for whom virtue is rather lax. And I'm not usually inclined to be moralistic about such things, but I do recognize how a lax moral life will put a limitation on how far a person can go in their spiritual life. So it's not a moralistic issue, but rather a pragmatic one. And so I really wish these people to kind of clean up their act for the sake of deepening your spiritual life. So they work on that parami for a while. And if they work on that parami of cleaning up their life, their integrity, then and they also feel they're doing it for the sake of others, so much the better. If they don't, it's still good. We still cheer them on. But it's not a parami then. Yes, Bill.
Generosity seems to me, in my life at least, for to some extent, has been to my personal detriment. I tend to be overly generous on all sorts of levels.
So one of the paramis that is important then is also wisdom. So just let up on the generosity thing for a while and develop wisdom.
But the second one is the second one in your list, you know, is the one that seems a little confusing to me. And I think it's a semantic problem, or a cultural semantic problem. Virtue. Virtue in the West, in the Judeo-Christian context, I think there are seven virtues, as there are seven sins, are kind of a mirror of each other. And it seems very vague to me if you say virtue. Is there another word from which this translates?
The word in Pali is sila. And sila is sometimes translated as ethics, sometimes as virtue. Integrity, is okay. Sometimes inappropriately it's called precepts, but I think it's more like inner quality, so virtue or ethics. And
because I think one of the seven virtues in the Judeo-Christian is generosity.
Great.
Honesty. You know, they're a different piece. Uh-huh. I can't remember them. It's been like 30 years since I've studied any of that stuff.
So Plato, to talk about the Greek tradition, Plato apparently said that if all things are equal between two people, they have the same conditions in their life and same experiences and all kinds of, if all things are equal, the one who is just will be happier than the person who's not just. And part of the explanation is that a just person is in harmony with him or herself. And that inner harmony is a happier state to be in. Whereas the unjust person will be kind of more not in so much harmony, more fragmented, more being pulled around by their desires and opinions and aversions, things like that. To paraphrase him in the Buddhist context, and maybe kind of building on this little discussion of the paramis, if all things are equal, the person with a trained mind or the disciplined mind will be happier than the person with the undisciplined mind. And kind of for the same reason. If the mind is undisciplined, who's in charge? And where are you going to go? You know. But if you're disciplined, and in a sense, you know, you're in charge, then you're not going to be pulled off, you know, in all kinds of directions that later you would regret. So that's another, you know, reason for developing the mind, training the mind. So in a sense, the paramis are kind of a description of the qualities of the mind or the heart that can be developed, be trained. And it's really a beautiful thing that the human heart, the human mind, is malleable enough to be developed if you have the persistence to hang in there and do it. It's amazingly malleable. Part of the reason is because the human mind is not a thing. It's a process. And since it's always a process in process, it actually can be quite malleable. And the thing that makes the mind most malleable and most shapeable, the tenderizer of one of the tenderizers of the mind, is concentration. A concentrated mind is a mind which is most malleable. So one of the reasons to cultivate concentration is that then the mind is malleable enough, tenderized enough, that these other practices you do, will have a much deeper, much more profound effect on developing your character. Yes, last one, and then we'll stop.
In reflecting on why compassion
is so important in connecting to each of the paramis, I think, is that compassion is a word that we use for a fact that gets ignored in Western culture, that people really are connected, and that it was that compassion in the Buddha, compassion in any spiritual leader, in Jesus, and that compassion even in like the 12-step program, that took that original getting your own mind together. Buddha could have just stayed, or Jesus could have just stayed where they were, but that compassion became the vehicle to carry the message to others. So, I mean, just in my own experience, like with generosity and working in a church setting, there's a difference between people who just give because it's good to give, unexamined giving, and the effectiveness of their generosity versus people who are connecting with that compassion of their tradition. So you see damage done when people and their generosity reinforce racial stereotypes or gender stereotypes, which I saw, versus people who use their compassion to move beyond it and change the world. So I think that's why it's important. It energizes it and moves it to that further level,
mm-hmm.
to do things of eternal significance. Those traditions are still ongoing. They can't just stay under the tree or stay at the Jordan River. You know, they are here, present, and active.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, it's really beautiful. The possibilities inherent in the human heart are really beautiful, in each one of you. And it's really one of the really marvelous things in life to somehow tap into and develop and cultivate those potentials in our own hearts. And it's not always easy. It's very difficult at times. And but if you think about it in the long term, there was an article I saw this weekend. I'll end with this, since we're running late. About a new kind of space probe, space rocket that they've invented that's going to go deep into the galaxies and all that. And it has this ion thruster engine that is a solar-powered kind of, you know, motor. And it just kind of pushes out a little bit of ions from the back. And the amount of thrust, apparently, is less than the amount of gravity that's or weight that's in your hand if you're holding a postcard. Which is almost nothing, right? And so how could that move a whole spaceship? Probably first they get it up into space. And then, you know, with a bigger rocket, and then they let it go. But the idea is, in the short term, it's going really, really slow. But there's almost no resistance in space. And so it builds up more and more speed. And over the long term, it actually ends up going much, much faster than a conventional rocket where they have to bring all this fuel with them, you know, to get it going. And so this thing about slow, you know, starting slow and slow and steady and thinking about the long term. If you think of your spiritual practice, you know, as over the 10-year or 20-year or 30-year, you know, this is how you know, remarkable things can be, even less than that, but remarkable things can happen to you. It's really, really amazing. So I hope that you take your own potential seriously and love it and enjoy it and have a good time. And I hope that this little exercise in theology today was interesting and provoking. So thank you.